Failure is not an option.
What difference at this point does it make?
Nobody said it was going to be fun.
This is Real Talk, a fearless, poignant, and intrepid show where truth speaks louder than words. This is Real Talk with your host, Audrey Russo.
The shame, not of this world, so we live on the run. We keep our eyes set, eyes on what is to come.
It happened before. It will happen again. It's just a question of when.
Time's a luxury we don't have.
This is Nani Darwis, author of The Devil We Don't Know, The Dark Side of Revolutions in the Middle East, and president of Arabs for Israel. You are listening to Audrey Russo on Real Talk.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, this is Audrey Russo, and you're listening to Real Talk. Now, despite the lack of coverage in the mainstream media concerning Islam's war on Christians, the war continues, and it's growing fiercer. We're going to find out more details with my next guest. For my new listeners, Raymond Ibrahim is, among other distinguished positions, a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center and a CBN News contributor. He's a guest lecturer at universities and governmental agencies, and he's testified before Congress regarding the abstract failures that governs American dialogue concerning Islam. He's also the author of several books, including The Al-Qaeda Reader and his latest release, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians. It's my great pleasure to give a Real Talk welcome back to Raymond Ibrahim. Hey, Raymond.
Hi there, Audrey. Good to be with you again.
It's always great to have you with us, and sadly, there's always a lot to talk about, so we're going to jump right in. People are thinking, why am I laughing? Because you have to laugh or you cry. We're going to start, if I may, with Pakistan. Pakistan has strong elements of Sharia, and I believe, if I'm correct, due to the former leader, General Muhammad Zia, I'm probably mispronouncing it, so please forgive me, Ul-Haq, whose primary policy or centerpiece of his government was Islamization. And maybe you can fill us in a little bit about that. But Raymond, how deeply rooted is Islamization, is the Islamization of Pakistan?
Well, Audrey, you have to remember that Pakistan historically was part of India. And what made it different was that was the region that there was a lot of Muslims in, who are, you know, ethnic Indians, really, who through the centuries converted through forced conversions, pressure, or whatever, to Islam. And so early in the 1900s, they separated, and the word Pakistan literally means land of the pure, because they take great pride in being able to say this is an Islamic Sharia-type nation. So definitely the Islamization aspect is the point here is it's from its origins, and even in its own name, that it's trying to be this pure Islamic nation. As far as the plight of Christians, who are roughly about 1% of the entire nation, it doesn't seem like a week can you, or even a day sometimes goes by without reading something that's pretty atrocious. So most recently, for instance, a man who was a Christian, young, and supposedly mentally disabled or whatever, that's what the reports are saying, was seen by Muslims burning newspapers that had Arabic Quranic verses on them. And that, of course, just, you know, sparked outrage and violence. They tried to burn him alive. Some reports say they did burn him, though the majority actually say he wasn't, and the police took him and arrested him, and now he's awaiting trial. And this goes back to the whole idea of how blasphemy against, there's an actual article in the Pakistani, in the laws and constitution, that bans or prohibits any kind of insult to the Quran or Islam or the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and so forth. And that is used habitually to basically punish any Christian, because also as part of Islamic law, a Christian's word is null versus a Muslim's word. So if you're a Muslim and you have a Christian neighbor and you don't like them or whatever, and this, is, in fact, is the story of Asia Bibi, as she's known, who's still on death row, a Pakistani Christian woman, mother and wife, who's on death row in Pakistan, because one of her neighbors just accused her of somehow insulting Islam, and it's, you know, outrages, riots, and she's in jail now waiting to be executed. And so this happens all the time. And before this particular anecdote of this young man that I was saying, a couple, a Christian couple, a man and wife, were also accused, and they were literally burned alive in an oven. And it wasn't, you know, an accidental, okay, you know, the mob was just being violent and they set them on fire. No, they threw them in the oven, and when the woman wasn't burned, they actually took her out and wrapped her in more flammable material and threw her back in to make sure she burned. And all this because supposedly she offended Islam's prophet and so forth, which we in the West should be familiar with. How that works, as we saw recently in violent Texas and so forth. So that's the situation in Pakistan, especially for Christians.
Wow. Was I correct in hearing that there are elements of Sharia actually in Pakistan's law, like the blasphemy law?
Yeah, the blasphemy law, that is in the government, in the Constitution. It's written in. You get arrested for it. And you go to jail for it, and you could possibly face execution. So, like I said, there's this woman, Asia Bibi. She's just one among several, I think, of Christians who are waiting in death row to be executed just because of no other offense than offending Islam's prophet. It's the same thing in Egypt. They have the same thing, but they use, you know, they're more subtle. They use the word, if you offend any heavenly religion, which means that in theory, if a Muslim offends Christianity, he could go to jail. But it is, you know, if you look at the reality, so Christians are maybe 10% in Egypt and Muslims are 90%, but probably 99% of the people in jail for the blasphemy are Christians. So again, you know, it's all often used against them in any way, shape, or form, but definitely Pakistan is the worst nation, aside from other, of course, Saudi Arabia and other places, but for a non-Arab country, it's one of the worst when it comes to this blasphemy issue.
Yeah. Also, isn't Pakistan where so far three former Muslim bloggers who would blog against Islam were murdered?
Yeah. No. Well, Pakistan and elsewhere.
Yeah. gosh, it's so incredibly insane. But you just have to go on to the next subject because it's there's so much. There's so many incidents now, and I understand that the recent, you know, enforcement by Pakistanis of the blasphemy laws is included burning Christians, of course, alive, which is even more insane. Were there any ramifications? Was anyone arrested for this?
Yeah. Well, the burning alive, that, you know, the government didn't burn the Christians alive, it was the mob. But, you know, if the mob didn't burn them alive, the government would have arrested them and possibly put them on death row, as with the other examples. But, you know, it's a well-known fact in Pakistan and other Muslim-majority nations that when Muslims rise up and attack minorities, Christians especially among them, it's very, very rare that a single Muslim will even be charged or taken to jail or anything like that, because once again, if you go back to Islamic law, a Muslim is never to prosecute another Muslim on behalf of an infidel. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's one thing to, you know, prosecute a Muslim who attacks another Muslim, but if it's an infidel, well, then you have to side, of course, with the fellow Muslim, because the infidel already is an enemy anyway, and we're not going to, you know, prosecute a Muslim for it. So this always happens in Pakistan, happens in Egypt, happens anywhere where you have Muslim majorities.
Yeah, I kind of figured, but I just thought by some fluke maybe somebody was going to pay for that, but I didn't think so. That, you know, Raymond, recently you shared about the barbarism on display in the social media by the Islamic State. They claim that they commit these acts because Muhammad did, and they perform these acts in the name of Allah. Now, Raymond, are these twisted acts supported by Islamic texts like the Quran and the Hadith?
They definitely are. If you look, you know, I think what you're talking about, there's a picture I just posted on my website yesterday, and it's some Islamic State member, ISIS guy, who took some, as I call him, an infidel, just an enemy of the faith, and he literally chopped him up. So he has him on a carpet, and he has his limbs separated, and he has his head off his torso separated from his waist, his legs. It's like, it's just straight butchery, like you're at a butcher shop or something. And now that sort of savagery and sadism, if you will, yes, it is definitely traceable back to especially Islamic history. I have in mind right now Khalid, his name is Khalid bin al-Walid, and he's known as the Sword of Allah, and he was a pimp companion, a friend of Muhammad, and also a jihadi warlord who helped in the early conquests of infidel nations and so forth. And this man, if you read him, he's till this very day, he's venerated by the jihadis, and they constantly mention his name, and he's someone they want to emulate and so forth. And if you read about this guy, I mean, he's just a mass murdering savage and rapist. So one anecdote in my mind, for instance, where he actually got in a little trouble with the caliphate under Omar is because he went and he found a Muslim who was accused of apostasy or so forth, and he ended up basically killing him, taking his wife, who was renowned for being beautiful, raping her, which, of course, the Islamic sources say he married her, okay, it's a euphemism. And then, after all that, he cut the head of her husband off, who he killed, and set it on fire, and basically cooked his food on it and ate it. And he did that supposedly to terrify the other apostates, okay. But then he got in trouble because it turned out that the man he killed wasn't even really an apostate, and that he only did this because he wanted his wife, who, as I said, was renowned for her beauty and so forth. And so you get this, what I just quoted to you, this just colors all of Islamic history. So there's really nothing that these guys are doing that they cannot find the precedent for, and that's why they can get away with this. You know, some people will tell you, well, Islamic State are just a bunch of psychopaths. Well, that may be, but the fact is Islamic texts justify this sort of behavior. So if you're a psychopath and you're looking for validation, you know, you can just become an Islamic jihadi, and all of a sudden now you have Allah on your side. So that's definitely a problem that's not being mentioned.
Yeah, I think, you know, what I found kind of strange just reading through, and I've been reading through your work for a while, how it seemed back in the times when, the time when Muhammad was alive, when they came up against a problem, seemed to get a word from Allah that was beneficial to him. Let's put it that way. It was never a hard saying for him, that's for sure.
His youngest wife, Aisha, you know, the child bride, when she was older, you know, a lot of people joke around about how she really knew what Muhammad was up to, because just like you said, anytime he was in a pickle, he would come up and say, you know, I just got a revelation from the angel Gabriel, from Allah, et cetera, et cetera, and it became a part of the Quran. And there's one anecdote where she just, you know, says basically, wow, it's impressive how your Lord always comes to your rescue with the revelation whenever you need him. So, for example, you know, Muhammad himself said that it was banned, you know, to have sexual relations with certain people whom women were related to, such as, for example, your daughter-in-law or something like that. And then all of a sudden, because he lusted after his, they called him a son, but it was like a stepson or adopted son, his wife, and he wanted her, all of a sudden, but he didn't take her because he knew it was wrong. Then he came up and said, Allah said it was okay for me. And it became it's a verse in the Quran, and now his son or stepson divorced her, or not stepson, his adopted son divorced her, and Muhammad took her, and then that becomes part of the Quran, but it's only applicable to Muhammad, just like, whereas a Muslim man can have four wives, for some reason, the prophet of Islam, ended up being able to have a lot more. So, yeah, just to add on what you said, that's definitely a very obvious aspect that a lot of, especially not apostates, Muslims who left the faith, always cite as one of the most obvious things that just made them doubt.
Yeah. I wonder why. I want to talk about that for a moment here. The listeners have heard about the plight of the Syrian Christians as well. I mean, it's all the Christians in the Middle East, but in particular, we're talking about the Syrian Christians. You had written about the fact that they found sanctuary in Beirut. Now, how safe, Raymond, and how long would they be safe there, considering Hezbollah's strong presence in Lebanon?
Well, you know, there's two aspects to it. What most people do, they have a very myopic, short-term view, and they just look at it, and from that point of view, you could say, yes, they're definitely better, because it's better to be in Lebanon, even though there's that Hezbollah presence, than to be in the Islamic State, where you're just being decapitated left and right. So that's a short-term view. The long-term view, though, is, you know, it's just not safe anywhere for the very same reason, okay? Because Hezbollah is another ISIS in another package and another name and so forth, which has not necessarily culminated to that, you know, full-blown jihadi savage mindset that ISIS has, but which definitely has the potential. And another point is to keep in mind, you know, these Christian minorities have been running away left and right, and the places they can go to keep running out. So, for example, Iraq was the first place that was quote-unquote liberated, Saddam Hussein and, you know, bringing democracy there and all that nonsense back in around 2004. So now it's the worst nation, basically, for any Christian or any non-Muslim, and it's, of course, one of the areas where the Islamic State is dominant. And the Christians there fled to Syria. And then, of course, the Arab Spring came to Syria, and the Christians there were persecuted, killed, attacked, and so forth. So now, ironically, the Iraqi Christians and the Syrian Christians are fleeing Syria, and they're running out of places to go. So now they're in Lebanon. But if that's what I'm saying about the long-term picture, is that's also going to end up one way or another, if things continue in this path, becoming just like the rest, whether Hezbollah takes over completely and it just becomes like another ISIS, because after all, they follow the same Islamic teachings, ultimately, even if they are Shia, it's still core teachings of jihad. Subjugation of infidels and so forth. So it's just a matter of time. If things don't change somehow, that these places will just keep getting worse and worse and worse, and less sanctuary for them.
Yeah, probably the only true sanctuary they can get is in Israel. Otherwise, they won't be able to. Raymond, in your article, Obama's Policies to Empower ISIS Exposed, you share some startling predictions you made in an article several months ago that were fulfilled. Can you share those predictions and the fulfillments with us?
Sure. 7 months ago, or closer to 8 months, Obama declared war, quote-unquote, by saying airstrikes, of course, on the Islamic State, and gave an address and so forth. And at that point, I wrote that prediction you allude to, and I based it on just how things always are. And again, this is about the long versus short-term view. Again, people tend to obsess over the short-term view, and they just follow the news nonstop, and, you know, bit by bit, and think every single event and word means so much. But what I do is I just step back and look at precedents and what's been going on. And what I predicted is you're going to hear that the United States or the Islamic State is getting weaker, and you're going to hear of all these kind of this or that leader is going to be killed and so forth. And then I said, in the end, and all of a sudden you're going to hear from the Islamic State itself, how it just conquered another huge piece of territory. And that's exactly what's been happening if you look over the past few months. For instance, the Pentagon, at one point, Kerry was saying how that more than half of ISIS leadership was taken out, and then a couple of weeks later, authoritative sources all over the media proved that that was complete nonsense. And then the Pentagon issued a map saying that about up to 30% of the places where ISIS was, they've lost territory. Then it turned out that while the map that they provided, the Pentagon, was accurate in showing where they lost places in 30%, it did not show the other large areas that ISIS had just conquered recently, which even amounted to more than 30%. So again, you had lying misrepresentations going on to prove something. Then there was recently, just like 2 weeks ago, I forget his name, Abu Saif, I think, was killed. And, of course, Carson of the State Department and Obama administration came out making their famous, you know, this is a, serious blow against ISIS. because some top-ranking leader was killed. And even the New York Times pointed out that he's like a mid-level nobody that will be replaced in no time anyway. And then, lo and behold, was it a week ago or less than 2 weeks ago, ISIS declared they got Ramadi in Iraq and Anbar province, one of the most strategic provinces, and now they're even stronger than before. So that's exactly what I foresaw, that you're going to get a lot of noise, a lot of nonsense on the media, a lot of talking heads giving you different analyses, and this is what's going to happen, and this is what this means. But in the end, it's always the same thing. The United States goes, claims it's fighting these groups, and then they grow stronger. I mean, remember, Iraq is where 10 years ago, more than, the United States went and ousted an actually strong government of Saddam Hussein and an entrenched military in 3 weeks. And then all of a sudden, that is the very spot that the worst possible thing sprouts out, a caliphate. And then we're supposedly fighting it, and we, who were able to take out Saddam in 3 weeks, can't take out the caliphate, which is nowhere near as consolidated in power and military might as Saddam Hussein was. We can't take them out, and they keep getting more and more land and growing and growing. So I think it's time for people to wake up and look at these facts, because they're very disturbing.
Yeah, and sadly, it probably the way it's being viewed from over there, it's anything that comes out of this White House seems to be a joke concerning what ISIS is doing. So, I mean, it's almost stand-up comedy to them if they laughed at anything. Anyway, because we know they don't laugh at anything. Anyway, so if we could, I just want to jump over to Italy for a second. Pretty much, at least from my reading since the 80s, it's been a growing jihadi, really, problem there. You shared about a Muslim teen beating a Christian schoolgirl for wearing a crucifix. Now, Raymond, we've talked about the Islamic footprint in Italy, especially Sicily, you know, hence the offer you can't refuse. I'm still laughing about that stuff. Italy has had problems in the past with Muslim activists, like, if I'm correct, Adele or Emilio Smith, who's now dead, challenging the display of crucifixes in public spaces. Now, does this problem with crucifixes reflect a position that Muhammad held about the crucifix?
Well, as usual, when you find Muslims engaging some sort of, you know, quote unquote radical, intolerant behavior, which of course is often dismissed as an aberration and not representative of Islam. But when you see it happening repeatedly, for instance, in Italy, you were referring to, he's of course just described as a North African or just African schoolboy immigrant who just came to Italy 3 weeks ago. And so he hits a native Italian girl, probably Catholic, for wearing a crucifix. At first he was taunting her and abusing her, and then he finally punched her. Now, if you stay in Italy, you're going to find that attacks on the crucifix and, you know, statues of the Virgin Mary and so forth happen all the time by Muslims, who are never, of course, called Muslim. They're called immigrants from North Africa. Now, so where does this animosity come from? Well, just as you alluded to, you go back to Islamic teachings, all those arcane texts that no one wants to touch because they're too busy reading secondary books written by Karen Armstrong that whitewash Islam and completely misguide people. If you go to these original primary sources, you will find that Muhammad himself did, in fact, find the cross or the image of the cross repugnant, that he did, in fact, destroy it, that there is a prophecy in Islamic teaching that we will, as in we Muslims, will destroy the cross, that Jesus himself, who is revered as a prophet in Islam and in the Quran, is believed to come back on the last day and destroy the cross because the cross is repugnant. And this all goes back to the Islamic Quranic teaching that Christ was never crucified and certainly didn't rise from the grave and so forth. So, yes, this what you're seeing, this little, you know, immigrant schoolboy doing to a schoolgirl, which seems so random and not tied to anything bigger, has a 1,400-year history and a long doctrinal trail and has been happening all the time.
Well, I believe last time you had mentioned something about why ISIS or the Islamic State always refers to Rome instead of Rome from it's this is going back in history, and I'm just curious if they have any presence whatsoever in Italy, or is there any support in Italy, Muslims in Italy, for them, and if they're eyeing Rome in this.
Audrey, wherever there are Muslims in this world, there is support for ISIS in that country. So in Italy, you can rest assured, I don't need to see any facts or data telling you anything. I already know for a fact, because Italy has a significant Muslim population, that a lot of that population is supposedly disgruntled and angry about this or that, that amongst them are definitely sympathizers and supporters of the Islamic State, just like they're here in the United States, and they're all over in Europe. So that they're sympathizers, because I think the problem is many people think they still maintain this idea, like they did before with Al-Qaeda, that ISIS is an organization and it has members and so forth. Now, that is true on one level, but the real threat of ISIS isn't the temporal organization. It's the idea of it, the idea of a caliphate, the idea of Muslims fighting jihad, the idea that it's all rooted in Islamic teaching. As long as this idea exists, then of course, as wherever you have a Muslim who picks up his Quran and reads the Hadith and the life of Muhammad and Islamic history, that Muslim will be a sympathizer for the Islamic State. So you can rest assured that they're all over the place.
Right. Oh boy, we have
just
a...
Just because they're not attacking right now, you know, is not necessarily indicative of anything, because there's always a right time and a wrong time.
Sure.
And in fact,
and they're very patient.
One of the most things that Al-Qaeda was criticized by fellow jihadis and Muslims and so forth was the attacks of 9/11, because it was seen as too early, and it would serve to do is wake up a sleeping giant, possibly. Maybe it didn't. I don't think it did, obviously. But it was seen as like a futile hit. So there's just because something is quiet, don't think that nothing's going to happen, because there's a lot of patience, there's a lot of plotting, a lot of planning for the right time.
Sure, sure. Now, I want the listeners to read more of your work. So where can the listeners follow and support your excellent work and purchase your books?
Thanks, Ari. The best place is just my website, because it has all every article I write for whatever publication goes on my website, including videos I do. It's just my name, RaymondDibrahim.com, RaymondDibrahim.com. And my books, especially my most recent, Crucify You Again, Exposing the Islam to the War on Christians, there's a link right there on the homepage. It'll just take you to Amazon. It's probably the best place to get it.
Excellent. And I will, as always, have those links and any information Raymond shared in my after show in all my social networks. And that includes links to the books. And thanks so much, Raymond, for sharing all this information, keeping us up to date what's going on, since we're not getting it in the mainstream media. Until your next visit, may God bless you and all of your work. Bye for now.
Thank you very much, Audrey. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.